Hello, world. It is I, Alan Cousins. I am in your speakers today because I have recently been approached by a few different people on the subject of heart rate variability, and rather than individually kind of go over it, I have a few presentations in the archives that I thought might be useful to put online and just kind of start the discussion of heart rate variability that can hopefully answer a few questions that some of you may have if you're diving into this for the first time. So this presentation I actually did in Tucson for our Tucson Endurance Corner Camp this year, and I figured it might be a good kind of kickoff point for those of you who might be interested in heart rate variability and you know, maybe not sure where to start and not sure what it's all about. If I'll run through the slides, and you know, if you have any questions or want to start some dialogue, by all means. You know, it's a topic that I love to talk about, and I think it's really useful and practically useful for endurance athletes. You know, especially at the higher levels. So, without further ado, let's kick it off. I've provided the slides on the site, and I'll call them out as I change slides so that you can follow along as we go. So the first slide is what is heart rate variability, and really simple explanation here. This chart is actually from Kubios, which is a software that you can download for free, and it is a really useful way of getting into heart rate variability. And it shows a straight line at an RR interval of around about one. And what this is kind of pointing out is when we take our resting heart rate, maybe it's 60 beats a minute, we sort of assume that our heart is beating rhythmically. You know, if it is 60 beats a minute, that's one per second. But what's actually, and that would be the straight line at that RR interval of one. But what's actually happening is that there's quite a bit of variation between beats. So some beats might be at 0.8 seconds, some beats might be at 1.1 seconds, and there's actually quite a variation, quite a deviation from what we might assume is kind of a rhythmic heartbeat, and there's a lot of use in tracking this variation, which I'll get onto on the next slide. So slide two. What does this variability indicate? The first thing that it indicates is how tired your nervous system is. So in an autonomic nervous system, automatic nervous system, if you will, when it's fresh, when the nervous system is fresh, there's actually quite a bit of variability in how quickly it fires. And an analogy I like to use that we're probably pretty familiar with is a power file from a group ride. So if you're rocking up to your weekly group ride and you're tired, you may be just kind of sitting on the back and doing all that you can, just grinding it out, just to kind of keep up with the pack and keep up with the group. If you're not tired, if you're feeling fresh and you're feeling peppy, the power file will be a lot more variable. There might be times that you go to the front, there might be times that you sprint for a city limit sign, and your nervous system works in a very similar way. The responsiveness that it shows is related to how tired it is. When it's purely in survival mode, then you won't get a lot of variability, you won't get a lot of responsiveness. But when it's fresh and ready for stresses to come at it, then you'll see a lot more variability right off the bat. So more specifically, when we start to kind of pull apart the different aspects of the nervous system, we have that traditional fight or flight division. So the sympathetic nervous system, the fight or flight nervous system, is the part of the nervous system that's devoted to responding to stresses. So we're talking about mobilizing energy. We're talking about getting through very, very stressful situations, you know, whether they're training stress, whether it's work stress, whatever the case may be. On the flip side, the parasympathetic or rest and repair nervous system is the brake pedal. So it's the let's slow things down, let's take a breather, let's regather some energy, and let's repair maybe some of the damages that were done from these bouts of fight or flight. So the tracking of HRV really goes a long way towards assessing what state you're in, be it fight or flight or be it rest and repair. Okay, moving on to the key numbers slide. So in terms of coming up with it with a number, in terms of quantifying what state you're in and how strong these states are, there's a few numbers that you'll see in the various software that are important. The first one is the RMSSD. So this is the root mean square of successive differences between your heartbeats, and I won't go into it in too much depth. I mean, you can kind of pull apart the definition to identify, you know, just how that's being calculated. But that's a number that you'll see fairly often if you look at the literature, and if you'll also see it in the more advanced features of a number of the apps out there. And that's a really good indicator of how strong the brake pedal is, how strong the parasympathetic nervous system is. The other numbers that you might see are the low frequency and high frequency components of the autonomic nervous system. So these are really good ways of assessing that sort of ratio between fight or flight and rest and repair states. So when the LF component is high, it's a good indication that the athlete or yourself are in a little bit more of a stressful state. When the HF is high, it's a good indication that the rest and repair systems are strong, that the brake pedal is working, and that you're able to slow things down and put the body in this rest and repair mode. So the LFHF can also be expressed as a ratio. So you might see a ratio of, say, 1, 2, 3, and that's a good indication of just how balanced these states are. And you know, obviously, that's something that we want our rest and repair state to be balanced with our fight or flight, our stress state. When we start getting out of balance, then recovery is compromised, and that's something I'll go into in a couple of slides. So moving along to the next slide. So what are the practical implications? How is this important to us as athletes? And there's a number of ways that I think our variability can be used and is a very practical use in terms of monitoring the training. The first one is prevention of overtraining, and this is something that the research has looked into right from the get-go, and there's a study here that I've referenced by Daniel Plews and Paul Lawson, among a couple of other researchers. The same Daniel Plews and Paul Lawson, who are the Plews and Prof, the geeks on the Plews and Prof podcast, so you can definitely check that out for some more info. But this is a great study that looked at a real world situation, a season of training for two high-level triathletes, you know, very high-level VO2 maxes of 70-plus, I think, from recollection. One was adapting well to the training, and one was not adapting well to the training, that you can see as the chart on the bottom there. The athlete on the bottom actually not only suffered performance decrements through the season, but wound up getting shingles. So there's obviously a health tie-in here as well to that non-functional overreaching that they term it. But basically what we have here is that RMSSD figure that I was talking about transformed to a natural logarithm. Just to smooth things out a little bit. And you can see the control athlete at the top, very smooth, not a whole lot of variation there through the season. If anything, it actually looks like the athlete trends up a little bit as fitness improves and as they get fitter through the season. Whereas the athlete who was overreaching on the bottom, there's a lot of wiggliness in the RMSSD line there through the season, and you can see it drops down quite a bit from around about 5 early in the season to 4 when they're in the midst of that overreaching period. And in addition, right from the get-go, there's a lot of variability in there, and that's something that is another good sign that the system's not doing too well, and it's maybe struggling to adapt to the loads. So moving along, point number 2, as far as the importance, the practical significance of this stuff for athletes: recovery from hard training. Another neat study that was done by Steven Seiler, who I'm a huge fan of. Looked at a couple of things, but one of the things that he looked at in this study was the difference in recovery time between very very fit athletes who had a very high RMSSD, in this case 107 milliseconds was the standard RMSSD for the fit group, the high recoverers, versus the moderately fit group who had an RMSSD of 83. And you can see the difference in recovery here after a high intensity workout between the two groups. So the athletes with the higher baseline RMSSD recovered much, much faster after high intensity training than the group with the low RMSSD. So this obviously has practical significance, practical implications on an athlete's readiness to do hard training. So before doing hard training, we ideally want the RMSSD to be high, and this is true both in a chronic sense and also on an acute day-to-day sense. Finally, as far as kind of practical implications of the heart rate variability stuff to athletes and things that I think that we can find useful in the field, training response. So a couple of studies here show the difference in training response between athletes with high heart rate variability, in this case the LFHF ratio that I was talking about, the ratio of the brake pedal to the gas pedal. Study by Hordler back in 2004 looked at 4 different groups of athletes. So this scatter plot is showing different groups, and looked at the relationship between their LFHF ratio and the change in VO2 max over a training period. And you can see that the athletes who had the lower LFHF ratios had the higher training response. So in other words, the athletes with more strength in the parasympathetic aspect, more strength in the rest and repair side of their nervous system, actually responded significantly better to a training program, actually got a lot more fitness bang from the training buck than athletes who were perpetually in that fight or flight mode, who had high high numbers, high LFHF numbers. So the low frequency component, the fight or flight component, was very, very high in these athletes, and the rest and repair wasn't as high. So again, this has direct implications on trying to strengthen those the parasympathetic side of the equation. The study on the bottom shows a similar thing. So it's looking at training response over 4 weeks between a group who used heart rate variability prescriptively. So there's a flow chart here that you can see, and training decisions here were made on the basis of daily HRV. So if daily HRV was high, then the athlete would do high intensity training. If daily HRV was low, they would do low intensity, easy training. And if it was low over successive days, they would rest. And by using this prescriptive approach, the training response was actually 4 times higher compared to a control group who followed a more traditional hard easy program, where it was arbitrary and wasn't taking into account their HRV. So hopefully I've whet your appetite by now enough to ask the question: how do we measure it? What apps are available? What can we use? I mentioned Kubios a few slides back. Really easy way to get into things. You can download that direct from the URL that I've provided there, and just plug in your Garmin, and you can get HRV direct from that Garmin, from a Fit file. Another option, which in some ways is easier. There's a lot of apps on the market now. HRV for Training is a really good one that I would recommend if you have an iPhone. iFleet, another great app that is athlete specific, and Sweetbeat is another fantastic app that I would recommend that also has some tools for improving HRV in terms of coherence training and sort of meditative practices, I guess, to try to boost your HRV. Also, if you have a Garmin 920, the IQ Store has an app that you can use to just start playing around with HRV. It doesn't have a lot of long-term recording function, but it does give you a number that you can start to use to assess the HRV. So in practice, what do I suggest? First thing in the morning, really important that because it's such a sensitive measure, that you do it at the same time of the day in the same circumstance. It will be different if you get up and kind of walk around before taking it. It's going to be different to if you take it first thing in the morning. So take first thing in the morning, whatever method you choose, and take for a sufficiently long period of time that we get sufficient samples. So depending on the measure that you're interested in, it can range anything from 2 to 5 minutes, the research would indicate, to get a good sample. So I think most of the apps now are 2 minute apps. So moving along to the next slide, what I've learned over the past year, and I think this is an area that I have a little bit of interest in context, because I'm not just looking at my own data, but I'm looking at a lot of athletes who I coach or who are just interested in heart rate variability, who've kind of reached out to me. So early in 2015, I wrote a blog series that you can find on this site that attracted quite a lot of interest, a surprising amount of interest from folks who were curious about heart rate variability and interested in playing around with it. And I established some really good dialogue with a bunch of different athletes over different ability levels, from pro triathletes and cyclists, all the way down to entry level athletes who are just as interesting because they have different types of stresses that they're dealing with, and you know, it's been really interesting to deal with folks who are working, you know, long hours, working night shifts, and get some context from that end of the spectrum as well. So in terms of the long-term data that I've compiled, 17 male and 8 female athletes, 22 to 63 years of age, so a huge age range, and a range of methods from the various options that I've chatted about. So what have I learned? Number one, better athletes have higher heart rate variability. Significantly so. So the fit of the athlete, you know, pro triathletes, pro cyclists, on the whole, have very high RMSSD numbers, typically close to 100. And you know, there's not maybe so much variation here as in the other groups. Fitness definitely comes into play with that RMSSD. Similarly, if I look at my Kona group, athletes who've qualified, they have very high RMSSD numbers. So in addition to being very fit, they also have very strong abilities to recover from training. So move down to middle of the pack, average numbers are around about 50. And then if we move down to more recreational athletes, some of those athletes who might have more of the day-to-day stresses to deal with, the numbers drop off again to a mean of 38. The second, moving along to the next slide, the second point of interest, healthier athletes tend to have higher HRVs. And low HRVs often precede illness or injury. So the picture there is of a good friend and someone who I've had some really good discussions with around heart rate variability. Christine Ross is a really, really good follow on Twitter if you're interested in learning more about HRV. Her area of interest is actually equine athletes, so thoroughbred racehorses and the like, and her area of research has been the relationship between heart rate variability and how it precedes serious injury and often critical injury for racehorses. You know, when they're at the point where they break something and they can't run anymore, often they're put down. You know, fortunately, we're not subject to the same consequences if our HRV is low and we injure ourselves. But it's still something that's very traumatic when you're in the midst of it, and something that I think we can learn from what she has discovered in working with her sample. And I've seen the same thing. You know, while I haven't done the math, athletes often get injured or get ill during periods when their HRV is low for them. So when it's statistically in greater than one standard deviation from the mean, those are the times that we often see athletes getting injured in terms of overuse injuries, and also getting sick, picking up bugs and picking up cold, flu, that sort of thing. You know, extending that, I think we often see things that we might not necessarily think are related, like bike crashes. You know, when you're tired and your nervous system isn't maybe responding as well as what it should, we see athletes falling over. So, you know, that's another area to be mindful of, and to maybe program some safer options when the heart rate variability is low. Point number three, interestingly, training intensity significantly more than load itself affects heart rate variability. So here you'll see some data from an athlete that I work with looking at changes in heart rate variability with different types of training and different types of stresses. So we've got some long rides, and you can see the impact that a 5-hour ride at an intensity factor of 0.7 had on this athlete. And obviously it pushed the HRV down a little bit, but nothing compared to a stage race, which had lower daily duration for 1 and 3 hours, but significantly higher intensity. And this is something that I see across the board. It's athletes have a pretty good ability to deal with load in the way of volume, but once we start to crank the intensity up, it has a significant effect on HRV. And this is also backed by the research, that research that I mentioned by Stephen Seiler. The topic of the paper was actually the impact of training intensities on HRV, and he found a similar thing, that training at intensities below the first ventilatory threshold, below about 75% of max, create minimal ANS disturbance, whereas once we start to get above that point, the ANS disturbance goes up significantly. So something to be mindful of. And the fourth point, moving on to the next slide, is that non-training factors significantly affect HRV. So this is actually my own data here from last year. And you'll see a huge dip there in January. And I was actually not training a whole lot during January. I was on a European vacation. And you can see the impact of travel here on HRV. The load recovery cycles from my normal training weeks are fairly easy to pick out in terms of the waves there. But it was actually a completely non-training stress that had the greatest impact on my heart rate variability. And this is something that I see over and over again, and I think is one of the greatest uses of heart rate variability. You know, when we're tracking training and we're tracking training stress balance and things like that, we sort of know when we expect athletes to be tired on the basis of the training that we're doing. But oftentimes it's these non-training things as coaches that we're not as aware of. So, by getting this additional window into an athlete's life, it really opens the ability to start to have those conversations around non-training related stresses as to the effect they're having on the system, and you know, maybe an athlete's not ready for load purely on the basis of a busy work period or family stress, you know, things that we wouldn't necessarily see from purely looking at their training data. So how do we improve it? That's the big question, and you know, a few things that I've found useful in practice in working with athletes now on HRV over a period of time, also with myself and in looking at the research, a few suggestions. So first of all, yoga, meditation. Going back to that brake pedal, you know, flipping that switch and actually turning that the rest and repair system on is tough in the modern world. It's a stressful world out there, and it's very easy to fall into patterns of being constantly jacked up and constantly in this fight or flight mode. So sometimes it takes something a little bit outside the box, a little bit maybe something a little initially uncomfortable for an athlete to flip that switch. And I think the addition of yoga in your routine is a really good way to do that. Self-myofascial release and massage is another area that the research supports as boosting HRV, and of course it has other benefits to an athlete, you know, from a soft tissue perspective and from an injury prevention perspective of keeping the soft tissue happy and loose. So it shouldn't be a hard sell to your athletes. Quality sleep, so by getting better sleep. We tend to see that athletes who have better sleep hygiene, have better sleep quality, also have better HRV. So, you know, again, those two things are very much related and something that it's worth paying attention to. And finally, those training factors. You know, we can't separate the type of training that we do from the state of the autonomic nervous system, and that's what that Seiler paper was all about. Very important that the athlete has sufficient base built up before subjecting them to a lot of intensity in the training loads. And finally, life factors. You know, as I talked about with the impact of travel on HRV, things that are completely not related to training have a huge impact on our ability to deal with training stresses. We're not dealing with different compartments of stress. It's all pulling from the same stress bucket. So, you know, we as coaches need to be mindful of all of the areas that that can add stress to an athlete's life. And as athletes, we need to be mindful of that as well. It's no point ignoring those busy work periods or ignoring those other stresses, family or otherwise, that might be affecting your ability to train and affecting your ability to absorb load. So hopefully this has been useful for those who are interested in HRV in terms of adding some context. As I said at the outset, hopefully it can inspire some more discussions via social media or email or whatever the case may be. And I, you know, it's an area of interest of mine and an area that I love to chat about. So yeah, definitely hit me up with any questions, and I'll make an effort to post some more of these presentations online now that I've kind of figured out how to do it. So thanks for listening.